So this week's parasha is Vayishlach, and I'm going to deal with really one narrow issue, which first began to bother me probably around 1983 or so, and I was actually given some direction, but I'm getting ahead of myself. First, the shiur this week is in the memory Le'ilu Nishmat Yitzchak Yishayahu ben Shmuel Meir and Avram Aryeh ben Shimshon. So may the Torah that we study help facilitate a Ilui Nishmatam. So in Perek Lamed Hey, which truth be told is after all the excitement. I mean, the excitement is earlier. I mean, we like the confrontation, Yaakov and Esav, even the pre-confrontation, Yaakov and the mysterious adversary. Vayomer Elokim Yaakov, kum alei beit el, v'shev sham. So actually, there's two interesting things. One is he tells him where to go to Beit El. Secondly, he tells him to settle there. Now, those of us who don't remember Beit El was the place where Yaakov had his dream or his epiphany. He saw the Sulam all those years before. But not only does he tell him to go there, he tells him, Shev Sham, to settle there. V'asei Sham Mizbeach, L'kel HaNirei Lecha Bivrechacha, B'fnei Esav Achicha. And essentially, God says, you remember you made this vow? This is like, you know, people in shul, that they make the pledges. So there's a joke about that, but we don't have time for the joke. Unless you prefer, then I'll tell it. Yeah, God says to him, okay, you made the pledge, it's time. V'yom Yaakov el beito ve'el kol asher imo hisiru t'alei ha'nechar asher betochechem v'itaru v'achlifu simlotechem. And we're a little disappointed there because he tells them, okay, now it's time for me to face God. God has called me in. So listen, you all guys got to get up to speed. We have to be prepared for this. Get rid of your idolatry, which is a little surprising. Is that things that they took from Lavan's house, things that they grew up with, or things that they took from Shechem? So it depends on which commentators you look at. V'nakum v'nale beit el v'aseh sham mizbech l'kel ha'one oti b'yom tzarati v'hi imadi b'derech asher halachti. And here Yaakov recognizes and says, you know, I have to serve the God who has been with me and who has protected me and who appeared to me and so on, which means Yaakov seems to be completely cognizant that he should be doing this, which of course then gives us a different question. So why hasn't he done it till this point? V'idnu el Yaakov et kol alei ha'nechar asher bi'adam v'et ha'nizamim asher ba'ozneihem v'yitmon oton Yaakov mitachat ha'ila asher im Shechem. And he goes and he buries it away. The fact that it's near Shechem makes us suspect that maybe it was things that were taken from Shechem. And the Stor of Din, of course, preceded this immediately. V'yisov v'yihi chitat Elokim el harim asher sivavoteihem v'lo retfurach v'ebnei Yaakov. Yaakov indeed was safe because perhaps we would have worried, because he certainly did, that after what happened with Shimon and Levi and Shechem, that people would want to take revenge. But nonetheless, there was this remarkable quiet, and God said, I will protect you. So apparently the protection is still there, which seems to be, again, in the background. He made this vow, and God said, I'll take care of you. And God is indeed still taking care of him. V'yisu v'yivo Yaakov Luza, asher be'eretz Kanan, hi beit el, hu v'chol ha'am asher imo. And he comes together with the whole am. This is probably the first time that they're described as Am Yisrael. They were called Bnei Yisrael previously, but this is Am Yisrael. V'yivin sham mizbeach v'yikor l'makom el beit el, ki sham niglu elav ha'elohim b'v'rchom b'nei achiv. And he builds this mizbeach, and he dedicates this, of course, to God, who had appeared to him when he ran away from his brother. And, of course, the whole delay issue is what troubles us. And then Pasuk Ched is the Pasuk which really bothered me, because everything else, you know, we can deal with, but this, there's so little information, and then we have the following thing tacked on. V'tamat dvora mineket rivka, v'tikaver mitachat lebeit el, tachat ha'alon, v'ikur shmo alon bachut. And there, Dvora, the nursemaid of Rivka, died, and she was buried in Beit El, underneath the Alon, the oak. And the place was called Alon Bachot, the crying oak. So now, one thing which is strange about this is we've never heard of her before. Maybe, unless we did. But we never heard of her before. That's one problem. Secondly, what is she doing here? That's the larger problem. Thirdly, she's probably not that young of a woman at this point. I mean, we're talking about, if this is Rivka's nurse, so then since then we've had Rivka, we've had Yaakov, we had Yaakov's children, and so on, so we have a whole bunch of generations, so this is no spring chicken, as it were. As I said, I remember around 1983 being troubled by this, and I don't remember much more than that. I remember, I hope, looking into various commentaries, and I saw somebody that I was friendly with. I actually saw him yesterday, which is ironic. And his name is Meir Lichtenstein, Rabbi Lichtenstein's son, Rav Soloveitchik's grandson. We were both in the Rav Shir at that point. And I asked him, you know, if he had any insight into this pasuk. And he said, no. He goes, but I know my grandfather has a whole thing about it. So, and by the way, that's enough. You don't need to know what he said. You just need to know sometimes where the right place to look is or the right thing to think. So I know that there's something here and he has a whole thing about it. Almost automatically means that whatever he has is not in other places. So that gave me opportunity to at least contemplate. So now we're coming back to this after, I don't know how many years that is, but now's the time to come back to it. So the Targum Pseudo-Yonatan writes in source 2, Umitet Devora Pedigota Derivka. So some of you may be familiar with that word, the pedagogue, or sounds more like the teacher of. The teacher of. So it's interesting. There's a Hebrew, Yonatan in 3, but Tamad Devora Omenet Sharifka. So they took it to be Omenet, but it means much more than somebody who is simply a nurse will keep an eye on this. Now, I said that she may or may not have been mentioned before. So I want to go back a second, and what we're going to do is going to fill in the information in order to understand what Rashi is going to tell us. First, in source number 4, when Rivka instructs Yaakov to run away, V'yugad l'Rivka divrei Esav b'na ha'gadol, v'tishlach v'tukar l'Yaakov b'na ha'katon, that Rivka heard, and over here Rashi tells us through Ruach HaKodesh, that she heard what Esav said to himself. That's why he says it's Ruach HaKodesh, because Esav said it in his heart, that he's going to kill Yaakov. So she goes and she sends it. She calls Yaakov, her younger son, V'tomar elav, hinei Esav achicha mitnachem lecha largecha, that Esav wants to comfort himself with your murder, which means that's the way he's going to get peace, is he's going to kill you. V'tabini shema v'koli v'kum barach lecha elavan achicha rana, go run away to my brother, to Haran, v'yashavte imo yamim achadim. And as we've said many times, we're never quite sure when the Rivka love on family, when they speak exactly how literally to take them, spend there a couple of days. Yeah, he wants to kill you. So then how long does it take to calm down from potential murder? Is that a week, a month, a year, 5 years, 20 years, as the case may be? So how much time has gone by? And then she says that, you know, till he calms down, Ad shuv af achicha mimcha, till his anger goes away from you, which sounds like, you know, maybe he'll get angry at somebody else and then he'll forget about you. V'shachach asher asitalo, and then he'll forget what you did to him. And then Rivka says, v'shalachti, and I'll send for you, v'lekachticha misham, and I'll bring you back from there. Lo mishkol gam shneichem yom achad. Why should I mourn for the two of you on one day? So just a note about that last phrase. I think a lot of us know a Chazal, we know these things generally from Rashi, that the mourning of both Yaakov and Esav eventually was on the same day, even though they didn't die the same day. Yaakov dies, and then there's a whole process in Egypt, coming out of Egypt, coming out of Machpelah, and then there's a Midrash that Esav was waiting for him, and someone kills him. The different versions of the Midrash, either it was Yehuda or it was Hushim ben Dan, somebody kills him, and therefore that fulfills this, what Rivka didn't want. It's a very strange thing to fulfill, that both of them are mourned in one day, even though it doesn't say that both of them died on the same day. But why mourn for them both on the same day? But one would presumably think that Rivka was no longer alive at that point to mourn either way. But let's continue. Rivka said, I'll send for you, which of course then leads us to a very simple question. Or let's phrase that again. Rivka said, as soon as Esau forgets about this, Yomim Achadim, a couple of days will go by, she'll forget about what you did, he'll forget about what you did, and then I'll send for you. So does she ever send for him? So that's really the question, the flip side of this. Did he ever calm down, or did he ever forget about this? And if she would send somebody, then who would it be the proper person to send? So we know one of our favorite theories is our theory of conservation of people. So we're going to conserve people here in a great way. In source number 5, it tells us, and this is back in Perek Avdalah, this is back when Rivka is but a young woman. We don't know exactly what her age is, even though some have suggested various ages. which means this is when Rivka is sent to meet Yitzchak the first time. You know, she sent together with the servant of Avram, and she sent ve'et minikata, and she sent together with her nurse. So now this becomes a little bit easier, and Rashi and others will use this theory of conservation of characters. And this is not a hard one. Over here we're told the woman who dies is, again, the pasuk in the source number one, pasuchet, batama dvora mineket Rivka. Who died? Dvora, the mineket of Rivka, the nurse of Rivka. And over here we're told that there was a nurse of Rivka who was sent together with Rivka. So that's pretty easy. So of course this is going to be the same person. And as I said, this is not a very hard argument to make. The only thing which is a little surprising is, well, actually the only things which are a little surprising is the age involved. And the other thing which is surprising is what in the world is she doing there? So that I just want to mention, based on geography, two possibilities. One possibility is that she's coming back to Israel together with the greater Yaakov entourage, and she's coming back home, which of course creates its own problems, which we'll come to in a second. And the other possibility is that she's being sent from Rivka, and she's going to find Yaakov, which presents other difficulties. So I'm just saying this is, if we'll imagine that the traveling is a north and south traveling, which is of course not precise, so now the question is, is she traveling together with everyone else going from north to south, or do they happen upon her? You know, what a coincidence, they found Dvorah and she dies and they bury her, right? And she's traveling from south to north, and she bumps in, or she finds Yaakov there along the way. And again, that would be, I'm just saying, is that there's two possibilities, just depending which way she is traveling. So with all that information, let's now look at Rashi in this week's Parsha, source number 7, Vatamat Dvorah. And Rashi immediately identifies the problem. Manyan Dvorah Bevet Yaakov, what in the world is she doing there? Right? Last we saw, she traveled together with Rivka, and she went from north to south. She went with Rivka, and she ended up in Rivka's home. I'm not sure exactly how to describe her. She's described as the nurse. Maybe this is not such a different position than Bilhah or Zilpah or so on. But by the way, there is one commentary I saw that described her as, why is she the mineket of, why is Dvorah the mineket of Rivka? Someone suggested, I saw it because it's her mother, which is even, on the one hand, so much more obvious. On the other hand, that's interesting. But the other problem is, why is she called Dvorah here and she's not called Dvorah previously? It means, if she's not the same person, then we have somebody dying who we've never met, and we're mourning somebody who we'd have no idea what they've done, which makes it really quite mysterious, which is really what bothered me the first time. If it's the same one, so why not just tell her name the first time? Why tell her name in death? And let's be honest about something else. There are many, many people who die in the course of the history of Sefer Bereishit. Most of the people who die, we don't know their names. We don't know anything about them. They live and they die. Why is her death mentioned? Why is the mourning over here mentioned? And that's something which absolutely does trouble, which is the first thing that Rashi identified as the problem. What is she doing here? Meaning, why is she here right now? Why is she there with Yaakov? Rashi continues and says, El lafisha amar Rivka Yaakov v'shalachti v'kachticha misham. Because Rivka said, I'm going to send for you. So that then becomes a really interesting thing. Who can Rivka trust more than anyone else? She trusts this woman that raised her. She trusts this woman who looked after her, which means she knows that this woman is, this Dvorah, is totally there for her. So she needs to send somebody on the mission. So this becomes the obvious candidate. So when, Rashi continues, Sholcha Dvorah etzlo lepadan aram letzeit misham. That therefore, what Rashi is saying is that she sends her all the way back to Padan Aram, and she's the one who then takes him out. Now, of course, this is quite interesting because we had no idea when Yaakov left. That was the surrounding information of him leaving. It actually sounds like as soon as Yosef is born, he says, okay, it's time to go, even though there is a significant delay afterwards getting all the, shall we say, all the affairs in order and all the financials in order. And he says, no, he's sent it to Padan Aram. But now let's continue. One more phrase in Rashi, and then I'll back down. I'll say that's not what Rashi meant, what I just now said. Umeta baderech. So now umeta baderech is one of two possibilities. One is she was sent to Padan Aram, and she made it there to tell Yaakov to come back, or she sent her to Padan Aram, and she never made it there. Rather, what Rashi is suggesting, and I think this is the meaning of Rashi, that she never made it to Padan Aram. She sent her there, but she bumped into them along the road, and she died along the way, Which means, again, what Rashi seems to be saying is, Rivka understands that Esav has calmed down, which, by the way, that itself we need to question a little bit, because that was something where we were perhaps unaware of, that Esav has calmed down, and therefore she sends this woman, Devorah, but Devorah never makes it, but she dies along the way. Okay, so therefore what we have over here is a traveling, she goes from south to north. As I said, I think there's room to read Rashi both ways. The way I'm understanding, she dies along the way, but she never actually made it to where Yaakov is. But meanwhile, Yaakov has started to make his way back, and they happened to meet along the way. Talk about biblical coincidences. It's, I'm really surprised. Well, sexism, ageism, I don't know what else to throw into this. But otherwise, you have a different problem. What in the world is she doing dying along the way over here? You know, where did we find this woman from? No, I do want to point something out. Yeah, there's a little born Rashi that we should look at. Tachat ha'alon, and she's buried underneath this tree. B'shifule mishra, she'em mishur milamala b'shifua ha'har v'kfura milamata. Mishur shabait ela yukorin lo alon. V'agada, after Rashi telling us what he thinks this means geographically, the Agada nitpaser sham be'evil sheni. There was a second mourning that took place. Shehugadlo al imo shemeta, that he was just now informed that his mother had died as well, which means that in this week's parsha now we knock off Rachel, Rivka, and Devorah. It could be three generations of that same family that died. But again, he says, no, somebody else died. And then he pulls out a little Greek. I actually emailed a professor of Greek, who's a friend of mine, to double check this. Not, I don't trust Rashi. I don't trust myself. I don't know Greek. The alon b'lashon yivani acher. And that's actually in the neutral, I learned. There's a masculine, a feminine in Greek as well, and alone it means another. And therefore, that alone b'chod, and they cried for another. That's the way the Midrash is reading it, that they cried for somebody else. That they cried for somebody else when you consider the life of Devorah. So who's Devorah? She's the one who literally nurses or educates or sustains Rivka. So now the source has stopped, but the person who was the beneficiary has stopped as well. So Rashi is telling us that what's really the significance over here? And again, I just want to pause for a second, because there really is a great difficulty with all of this. What's really the problem that Rashi's dealing with? Who in the world is this woman, and why are we mourning her death? And what's the answer? Oh, she's actually the nurse of Rivka. Okay, that we're told. What's she doing here? Well, Rivka had sent her on a mission. Okay. Why are we crying for her so much? Oh, Rivka also died that day. So why not just say that Rivka died? Just say Rivka died, and that will solve it. Anyway, the source of this Rashi is number 8. It is the Midrash Rabbah, where it cites the Greek as well. So, and it talks about the mother dying. And as I said, one can look at that also. There is a very strange approach. And I say strange, it means it doesn't resonate with me, and I apologize. But what I have in front of me is the Pirush Rashbam HaShalem Ala Torah. This is a volume of Rashbam. The Rashbam was not printed for many, many years, and this is one of the original modern printings of the Rashbam. He says a couple of things in this week's parsha which could be that we would feel somewhat difficult. And it's not just that one, it's one after the other, because he has a whole approach that he wants to, not just to share, that he wants us to understand. So I'm going to read a little bit of it. So Yaakov, and we're starting in a whole different place now, Yaakov sends messengers, and he sends them to Esav, and he commands them, you know, bring these and these gifts. So the Rashbam writes, V'itzavotam limor, tzivaotam v'amar lahem, ko tamrum, v'hashluchim lo yadu dagatosho Yaakov. And the messengers never sensed how worried Yaakov was. And that to me is quite strange. Yaakov's afraid because Esav had said he's going to kill him. We have no other information. When it then says that they come to Esav and they see that he has 400 men, the way that I would read that, And the way that Yaakov reads that is, I'm in big trouble. It says that he was very, very worried and very, very concerned, very afraid when he hears that he's coming. And the Rashbam writes, Banu el achicha el Esav umatzat techin beinav. And he was delighted to hear the news. Kasher Marta, v'gami nehu mitoch shesameach v'biatcha, because he's so happy that you're coming home. Ubavato atcha, because he loves you so much. He's coming to greet you with 400 men in entourage in order to honor you. And then he has to add three words which bother me more than anything else that he said, and that takes a lot because I'm bothered by everything. Zehu ikar pshuto, and that's pshat. So I don't know what to do. Of course it's not pshat. How can you possibly say pshat? And he runs this interpretation all the way through. How in the world can you say that this is pshat? Because Yaakov doesn't know pshat, which essentially means, and again, I just want to talk this out a little bit, and then we'll see how this fits in to what we've been doing. I know it sounds like a little bit of a detour. He's claiming that Esav is happy, and Esav is good, and Esav, you know, bygones, forgot about everything, and the only one who has a guilty conscience over here is Yaakov. Yaakov, the one who's walking around with all the guilt, and Esav is completely fine with it, which means what he's really doing is and this I want to be careful, not that I'm here to judge, but I think what I'm about to say now is in his mind and has a lot of merit, and that is, don't be so quick to ascribe to Esav every single negative trait imaginable, which is what we do. And the reason we do it, we all know this, is because when we hear Esav, we hear Rome, and then we hear Christianity, and these are the people that destroyed the Beit HaMikdash. They're not just looking at one individual, we're looking into the future as well, and therefore all these negative things are ascribed. It's not just the biblical Esav we're talking about, it's what emerges from Esav that we're looking at. So to say that that's an overstatement, and therefore the pshat is that Esav isn't that bad, I really can't accept. Which means the day that Esav comes in from the field, so what did the Mefarshim say there? The Midrash says that on that particular day, he murdered and he raped and any other negative thing you can think of, he did that day. So you know what to say? You know, that's not talking about him. That's talking about Rome, and it's talking about, you know, other events that did happen in the future and ascribing it all back to him, that I understand. But there are certain things that Esav does which really are quite superficial, and I don't have to go through all of them. Esav marries local girls, which upsets both of his parents. That was like the one thing that his father told Yitzhak not to do, that Esav does. And when he learns that his father's upset, he doesn't get rid of them. He takes another wife. Okay, Dad, I got the wife for you that you can be happy with now. The day you come over for dinner, I'll make sure that the wife that you like is around. I mean, there's something really disturbing and superficial about that. The other thing is that you have a disagreement with your brother. I'm going to kill him. Okay, then I'm not so sure. Okay, I'm sure most of you, I know you people, okay, have said it somewhere, and I'm going to kill you, but you didn't really mean you're going to kill them, and so on and so forth. But to show up for the reunion with 400 people, who I really would have understood as being soldiers, it means, how convincing was that point? Oh, I'm so happy to see you. I'm bringing the marching band with me, right? I'm hiring all these people in order to greet you. That was the point that the Rashbam lost me, and that just doesn't ring true. Which means, as I said, I appreciate that we shouldn't overly, I don't know, vilify Esav, but that doesn't mean we should whitewash him either, which means there are things about Esav which are disturbing, and this is one of them. On the other hand, what's the advantage of the Rashbam? You know, I have to go like this and then go back. What's the advantage of the Rashbam? So what happens when they finally meet up? Why does Esav break? Which means something else does happen over there, and that needs to be explained, and that's something which we've discussed in the past at length, which I'm not going to get into right now. But Esav ends up, you know, being very un-Esav-like and well-being. So therefore, to say that Yaakov was confused and Esav was nice and Esav was... So there is something which is disturbing, especially around the 400 men. But I just want to go back to this point now about potentially sending Dvorah. Right, I want to go back to Rashi, because again, I can just imagine now the Rashbam, who probably learned Chumash with Rashi. I hope you appreciate that. Okay, I'll say it again. The Rashbam learned Chumash with Rashi. Okay, that was his grandfather. He learned Chumash with Rashi. He didn't just learn Chumash with Rashi, he learned Chumash with Rashi. So, okay. Okay. I have to work so hard here. You guys are so tough. Yeah, you guys are so tough. So he learned Chumash with Rashi and Chumash with Rashi. So he certainly knew about this approach in terms of, oh, what's Devorah doing there? Because Rivka sent, but why did Rivka sent? Because Esav calmed down, but Esav didn't calm down. He sent 400 men. So now I have a solution to that. No. Again, I just want to follow this Rashi. No. Rivka knows that Esav really has calmed down and is happy and misses his brother and so on and so forth. And I'm going to say that, okay, so maybe this helps that Rashi, even though in my mind we just have far more difficulties than we've solved, but I couldn't ignore this. By the way, I am somewhat convinced that when the Rashbam tries to convince us this is pshat, then I know that it's not really pshat. Right? Anytime somebody says, no, this is really pshat, then you know it's not really pshat. Because if it's really pshat, no one has to try to convince you this is really pshat. Which is, you know, the old problem, what exactly is pshat? And that we know the answer to. Whatever I say is pshat, whatever everyone else says isn't. So that's essentially the way the Jewish world has operated for a very long time. But when you have to insist it's a little bit less convincing. Which is really brings us to next week's parsha, which we're not going to talk about right now. But the Rashbam goes on he almost gives an introduction to his commentary in Vayeshev. Let me explain to you what pshat is. And then he gives us another interpretation, which he insists is pshat, which again brings me to suspect that it's not pshat. I'll tell you what my suspicion is, and this is just a suspicion. One of the things that was going on in the Rashbam's lifetime are things like the First Crusades. His brother Rabbeinu Tam was almost killed during one of the Crusades. It was not a wonderful time for the relationship between the Jews and Christians in the part of Europe that he lived. And next week's parasha, he's going to insist that the Jews, the brothers, Yehuda, did not sell Yosef. He'll insist, no, they didn't do it. I mean, because of the turn of language, and he said, no, they didn't do it. Which, to my mind, is difficult, especially since we have an eyewitness who tells us they did, and who does that eyewitness? Yosef says, you know, you sold me. So, especially when he's trying to make up with them. So how could the Rashbam say that, okay, so Yosef was confused, Yosef didn't know, I mean, Yosef was there, so when the only eyewitness to the whole thing says that you guys did it, but I forgive you, rather than them saying, no, it really wasn't us, you know, yes, we threw you in the pit, but someone else sold you, so it's a little less convincing. So what brings the Rashbam to say this is because that was part of the anti-Jewish sentiment at that time, was that the Jews, Judas, was involved in the sale of Jesus, and therefore Judas and Judah is the same character, and therefore this is a very, very clever self-defense in a theological fight which is taking place by claiming to the Jews, what are you talking about? We were not involved in this. We didn't sell him. Yeah, we weren't nice. We threw him the bit, but someone else sold him, and therefore he tries to, and he says, no, that's pshat. This is pshat. Because he wants to insist that that's pshat. It may, and now just keep that in mind, because I'm pretty convinced that that's what happened in terms of the sale of Yosef. If we go about over here, again, Esav eventually comes to represent Rome and Christianity, the church, and so on. And we have over here this, I think, really interesting point that he's making, which is the inverse. He's saying to the Jewish community, Esav really likes us, and really is happy to see us, and really wants to make up with us. That's I'm saying in the middle of the Crusades, again, I have to check the exact years when this was written. I mean, I'm saying as a sermon, if he gets up in shul and says this, listen, by the way, there really needs to be brotherly love over here, and it goes all the way back. It is the most optimistic Dvar Torah I've ever seen in my life. If that's, when you think about the social history, about what's taking place at that point, it's unbelievably optimistic. And as I said, I just wonder when the Rashbam says, no, this is really pshat, and he has to try to convince us to what extent he's working really hard and to what extent there are some other, shall we say, motives that he may have that leads him to say, well, this is really the pshat of you. Although I will again point out that this, in my mind, very difficult Rashbam may help Rashi in terms of understanding, so why in the world did she send her now? Because for everything that we know about now, unless you want to say it happens like this, the Yaakov and Esav have their confrontation, they then go their separate ways, And then Rivka goes and sends her to tell him to come back. But why? Then Yaakov knows, because Yaakov met up with him already. So that's a little difficult. So one would have to say that it happened before. But if it happened before, then Esav goes with 400 men. So I'm saying that's why I like this Rashbam, even though I don't like this Rashbam. But that's why I like this Rashbam, because he claims, no, the 400 men are really there to make a really big party, which, as I said, is very hard to convince, but would be consistent with what Rashi is saying over here. Are we good? Rabbeinu Tam, I told you, Rabbeinu Tam is the Rashbam's younger brother. Rabbeinu Tam, I don't believe, studied Chumash with Rashi. He died when Rashi was, when Rashi died, Rabbeinu Tam was 5 years old. His teacher was really his brother, the Rashbam, who was 15 years older. Sometimes you have in Tosfah, the Rashbam says this, Rabbeinu Tam says this, and then the Rish says this. So you don't realize that the Rashbam is the Rabbeinu Tam's older brother. Just for example, like the argument of when you make tea, do you need a Kli Sheni or not, a Kli Shlishi, and how this works. So what do they do in their house? I mean, these are the people that are arguing back and forth about this. And the Rish, by the way, is the nephew of both of them. So you have Rashi's grandchildren, great-grandchildren are basically the ones who are the foundational positions found in Tosfot. So just a couple more things along the same lines over here. In source number 10, the Chizkuni says, Ve'et miniktad, you know, this woman who nurses her, binurata, a long time ago, viskira akshav, and it's told now. This is when they travel. This is back in Kaf Dalet, when Rif is going to travel, she sends the woman who was once her nurse. Because what the Chizkuni is trying to tell us, she's not still nursing, she's not that young. Even those of you who think she was 3 years old, as I said many times, that's quite unlikely. The reason that we're told about her is for one reason, that when she dies, you're not going to wonder, where in the world did she come from? So that's why it's mentioned when she left. Then the Chizkuni, now when she dies, tells us, Devora, Pirish Rashi, Manin Devora Beit Yaakov, Klomar, Mehecha Nimtzeit Devora, Im Yaakov, Harei Ktiv, Kibim Akli Avarti, right, I left by myself. So again, it must be, the Chizkuni continues like Rashi, it must be that she was sent in order to bring him back. So he's understanding the Rashi. Remember, I told you there's two ways to understand it. He's understanding this tradition that she sends him, tells him that Esav has calmed down, which, by the way, is not all that clear when he comes actually with his 400 soldiers, and they do sound like soldiers to me, and that she sends him, and Yaakov doesn't want to come. Which, by the way, actually fits in thematically. That's what's nice about the Chizkuni. It fits in thematically with this whole section. How so? How did this section begin? That God tells Yaakov, it's time to keep your vow. It's time for you to go do the things you have to do. And then Devorah dies, which means had you done what you needed to do, you know, all of this would have happened much, much earlier. So as I said, there could be some kind of a connection there. The Rashbam 13, I did quote a little bit here. It's the Ikar Pshuto, so you do have that Rashbam. The Ramban is going to give us a whole nother interpretation, but before I do the Ramban or parts of the Ramban, I do want to look at something which you may be a little surprised with. In source 19 is Rav Avraham ben HaRambam. So as much as you all imagine the Rambam as like the ultra-rationalist, I do want to point out what his son writes here. V'tomot Dvara, Sipur Tara Lezemara al Godel Kishrona. That the reason the Torah tells about this in order to inform us about her greatness. V'fshar Shahayu Mivakrimit Kivra. And her grave later on becomes a place of pilgrimage that people come and pray. So it says that this is like the original Kever Rachel, which of course is ironic because Kever Rachel also appears in this week's parasha. That this is the place that people would go and pray because of her greatness. And he also throws out, they would come, Kamosha Nashe Yisrael Yu Nikraot Al Shema Lebracha, and many women were named after her, Kamosha Matzinu Devora Eshet Isha Nevia, that the later Devorah, and by the way, a number of people do this now, will connect the Tomer Devorah together with this tree of this Devorah and say that there must be some kind of connection between the two of them. But he goes so far as to say is that she was such a great woman, people are named after her, and her grave became this place of pilgrimage. So let's go back to the Ramban now. 14, but we'll just say how much of it we want to do. He starts off, "V'tamut dvor mineket Rivka," and he starts off and says, "Lo yadati lama nichnas apasuk hazeh bein vayikra lamakom el beit el." He goes, "I have no idea why we're being told about this now." Well, the reason is because she's buried right there. Why in the middle of this whole story are we told about her death? So next paragraph, he begins, "V'karov masha amur rabotenu shir mozlamitat Rivka," and he goes, and therefore there seems to be great merit in what the rabbis report, that there's another issue here, and that's the death of Rivka. "V'lochein kara shema makomahu alon b'chot," right? "Kein bechi v'anaka alminikata zekena." He goes, how logical there'd be so much mourning for an old woman. I mean, your point, she's old, why send her? If she's as old as we think she is, okay, it's sad that she dies, but the description of mourning, so again, he follows what Rashi had said before, which is found in the Midrash, that there seems to be this feeling that we're talking about another person who died as well. He then cites another Rashi that we didn't bring inside, but let's look by the next paragraph. "V'kotav Rashi fi shehalimu ad yom mota shelo yikalalu ota habriot keres she'atzami menu esav afakatuv lo pirsama." It's because that, why not talk about Rivka? Because the eulogies that people have to give. Oh, she had two sons, and one of them was Esav. This goes back to our vilifying Esav and saying, you know, that's why it had to be hidden. There is a continuation on this theme that during the funeral itself, who would have been involved? That Yitzchak is elderly and blind, assuming he's still alive. Yitzchak lives a long time. Yitzchak lives all the way through Mechirat Yosef. But assuming that Rivka has passed away already, so Yaakov's not there, Yitzchak's not really functioning, so the only one who could have buried her would have been Esav, or if not, maybe he didn't even bother, because we never see Esav have any kavod for his mother. So it could be that even he didn't involve himself in her burial, and she was buried by the locals, by the Chitim, which would have been something which would have been a little bit embarrassing. So, you know, as much as when Yitzchak dies, we're told, oh, and he was buried by Yaakov and Esav and so on, or when Avram dies, oh, so we're told that Yishmael and Yitzchak, or Yitzchak and Yishmael, take care of the burial. But over here, when Rivka dies, there's nothing to say because nobody took care of her. The fact that she is mentioned is what's more strange. That Devorah is mentioned is the strange point over here, because the default would be we don't talk about people. But I just want to go back to Rivka for a moment, because what's being claimed over here, again, it's easy to say you don't mention women. But let's be honest, 99.9% of the men are not mentioned either, you know, when they died and so on. We're not told about most people in Bereshit, we're not told when they died. You're right. More of the people that we're told, more men than women, I accept that completely. The outlier is why we told about Devorah. So now we're told, oh, there's actually, we're mourning so much for her, not because of her, because Rivka also died. So now the question is, okay, if Rivka died, and that's really the point, why not just tell us that Rivka died? Which means, we're claiming Rivka died now, we're mourning Rivka. Okay, so tell us Rivka died. No, that had to be suppressed. So why did it have to be suppressed? So now we're getting to various opinions. Well, it could be because nobody bothered to bury her, and nobody was involved, and there's something really tragic about her burial itself, and therefore it was being suppressed. So as I said, that's the suggestion which ends up coming up, but we're still stuck a little bit with Devorah. What I mean is that Yaakov wasn't there, Yitzchak was blind. Now the whole question is, did Esav do it by himself, or did the locals do it? When I say nobody, I mean that none of the family members were involved. So let's continue now the Ramban on top of page 3. "Vaitat Devorah im Yaakov." Now this again was more the way that we saw the Chizkuni. Again, I'm going to say this one more time. Rashi says that Devorah was sent, and she died along the way. I suggested there are two possibilities. One is she sent to Yaakov, and she never actually got there, and she died along the way. And the other is, what the Chizkuni says, she was sent, and she gets there. But then we have a problem. Why didn't he come back? Right? Why does God have to tell him, time for you to go back? Because he didn't listen. Now, why didn't he listen? So apparently he's still afraid. But why is he still afraid? By the way, this goes back, as I'm going to say it again, the theme that we started with. God has to remind him to go and do the things he needs to do. But did he have reason to be afraid of Esav? Well, according to the Rashbam, maybe not. According to everyone else, yes. "Vaitad Devorah im Yaakov." Devorah was with Yaakov. "Ki acharei sheba'a im Rivka shava arza." Stop. The Ramban says, what do we know about her, about this woman? She was this woman who had previously nursed Rivka. She accompanies Rivka on the trip to Israel, on the trip to meet her husband. And how long does she stay? And again, we never find her again. The only time we find her again is when she's dead. So Rashi, of course, told us, oh, Rivka kept her word and sent this woman. And the Ramban says, what are you talking about? It seems to me that she would have gone home much earlier. Vatatavom Yaakov lerot gvirta, that she went home right away, or much, much earlier, years ago. We don't even know how many years ago. Could be that she was with Rivka for a year, two, three, five, how long you want to say. And she goes home. She goes back to her life. She's like a foreign worker who comes for a couple of years. Her visa runs out. And she goes back home to her family. So, but then what happens when Yaakov and family pick up to travel to Israel, she says, I want to go with you. I want to see Rivka one more time. But now go back to your point, but you're an old woman. It doesn't make a difference. I want to make this one last trip. But sadly, she never makes it. And she dies along the way. And we're told, and then again, I'm not sure if this is poetic justice or not, but we're told that Dvorah dies the same day. You know why it's interesting? Remember I quoted before, and Rivka says to Yaakov, I'm worried I'm going to mourn for both of you on the same day. So now we have a midrash that they mourned for Rivka and for Dvorah the same day. So it's like Dvorah's words in verse flipped over, going about Rivka's words about herself and about Dvorah, rather than about Yaakov and Esav. Continuing the Ramban, second line, O netaska bigdol b'nei Yaakov l'chvod Rivku l'avata v'ayta b'veito. And then he continues and says, the woman who raised Rivka was the woman who lived in Yaakov's house and helped Yaakov raise his children. Which just becomes so much more interesting. V'yitachen, and I hope you love this in the Ramban. It's possible. I mean, he's telling you what he thinks is possible. V'yitachen she'ena hi amineket she'enem arba. Maybe it's not the same one. Maybe don't use your theory of conservation of wet nurses. Vishlechu at Rivka chotam vet minikata, avayta minika acheret shenishara bevet lavan ubetuel. Vata yavi oto Yaakov imo lechakel et sevata lechvod imo. And he decides he's going to bring her home in honor of his mother. This is the woman that nursed you. I want to bring you back. Ki ken derech hanichbadim liot leminikot rabot. And your difficulty that you had, that's really unlikely that he sent, that she sent such an old woman. So now you see that the Ramban says the same thing. Which now leads us to Rabbi Soloveitchik. So I started by telling you that I had a hint that he said something. So of course I had to look out for it, but I could never find it. Now, in the last number of years, there was a wonderful set of books which were published, Mesorat HaRav, Dr. Arnie Lustiger, collected Rav's writings from all over, literally from all over the place, and he put together a nice five-volume Chumash. It is, for those of us who've had difficulty understanding Rabbi Soloveitchik's writings or understand whom he's speaking, this is something which is worthwhile having in your homes. Certainly worthwhile for rabbis having in their homes. He takes the Rav's long, long essays and turns them into little bits of Perushim on various psukim. So here I found something the Rav said about it. And as I said, I knew that he had said something because I was told this, but I could not find what. And Dvorah, Rebecca's nurse, died. Rashi comments that Dvorah was the same nurse who accompanied Rebecca when she left her father's house. Rebecca, we know, was a young girl who exhibited extraordinary chesed, as indicated by the incident that took place at the well between Eliezer, Abraham's servant, and Rebecca. Rebecca was brought up in the house of Betuel and Lavan in a pagan orgiastic society. How did she exhibit such great humility and chesed typical of a daughter of Abraham? Why was she not influenced by her family and society? And here is where the Rav developed this concept. There must have been an underground community in Haran preaching Abraham's morality. Rebecca was part of this underground movement. She studied and absorbed Abraham's philosophy and adopted his Weltanschauung, living by his principles of justice and righteousness. Why was the death of an old woman so significant that it was recorded in the Torah? Apparently, Dvorah played a major role in shaping the history and the destiny of the Jewish people. Dvorah's death and the naming of the place where she died was recorded because her life was historically important. Dvorah was the leader of a moral underground movement. So now you know why he's the Rav and he gets the big bucks. But I want to explain this.
Where does he get this from? It's very nice. Where does it come from?
That one line in the Ramban. The Ramban almost said it. But one second. I'll look at the Ramban again if you want, but I'll explain to you what he's saying. And the Ramban where was it? On page 3, where he writes, at the end of the first line, Vatatavom Yaakov l'rot verita, O nit'aska b'gidul b'nei Yaakov v'chvod rifko l'avata v'ayta b'veto. She helped raise these children. So why would she be the one to raise the children? So he essentially asked himself, why is she the one to raise the children? Aren't we worried about pagan influences and so on? But he did one more piece of information. Remember we're told when we first meet Avram and Sarah, called HaNefesh Shasu B'Charan? Where does this story take place where Yaakov is living? It's by Haran. So now the question becomes, did all of the followers, all the Nefesh Shasu B'Charan come with them, or did any of them stay behind? So what he is in fact saying, again, I want to explain Rabbi Soloveitchik's point, and this is really embellishing that line in the Ramban. What he is saying is that this woman was a student of Sarah. Remember? We're told by Rashi, Avram is the one who teaches the men, and Sarah had a seminary. Sarah opened up a seminary, and she taught the local women. Many of those people followed Avram, followed Sarah, and they came with them from Haran to Eretz Canaan. Some stayed behind. One who stayed behind was a member of the larger household of Avraham. And she stayed behind, and she eventually became the woman who raised Rivka. Now, why did Rabbi Soloveitchik say this? He told you why he said this. Because the behavior of Rivka is so outstanding, which means essentially there's two possibilities. I'm willing to accept either. One is she's a spiritual genius like Avraham, and just like Avraham discovers the world, discovers God, discovers that God creates the world out of chesed, and therefore he must do chesed, or somebody taught her the teachings of Avraham. So he went for the second approach. Somebody taught, but who could have taught her? Well, a student of Sarah. A student of Sarah and Avraham. Who's that? Well, that's Devorah, because she's the Mineket. She's the one who nurses. By the way, there's an interesting midrash, which is the flip side. It says that by Avraham, there were no breasts that nursed him. And he uses that language. That where did Avram get it from? He got it from his kishkas. That's literally what the Midrash says. He got it from himself. He understood it by himself, but there was no one who nursed him, meaning nursing wisdom. The wisdom. So it's so interesting then that the flip side over here is that this is the nurse who nurses Rivka. This is the nurse who teaches Rivka, because it's not talking just about milk. That's what's just now happened. The Ramban already did this. This is the one who nurtured. Remember the Targum Yonatan? You said, where did he get it from? What word did the Targum Yonatan use? Pedagogue. This was the pedagogue of Rivka. This was the one who taught her. Well, taught her based on what? Okay, now I just went back to Rabbi Soloveitchik, and I can say he got the whole thing from that one word in the Targum Yonatan. Right? Mineket Rivka, pedagogue. She was the teacher. The teacher. Where did the teacher come from? Who taught Rivka to become a Balad Chesed? Who taught Rivka to be decent? Who taught Rivka to go and to feel towards others, to have empathy? Who taught Rivka Avraham ideals? The answer? Devorah. And now, what did he add? The star pupil. We're embellishing a little bit. He can embellish, we're embellishing. The star pupil of Sarah. Now I want to go one step further. She travels, at least according to Rashi, she travels, and we'll go back to our theory of conservation of pedagogues, of teachers, of nurses, and so on. She travels with Rivka and comes with Rivka and does her job as long as she needs to be there. Rivka's okay, Rivka's set up, she goes back home. Or Rivka sends her back home. Why would she send her back home? Because Rivka knows that her sons can't marry somebody local, and she knows that someone's going to have to teach the next generation of matriarchs. So therefore, this underground that he's talking about, this underground movement, may have actually been stronger than we imagine. It could be that Rivka understands exactly who this woman is and says, go back, there's going to be more for you to teach. Does she know Rachel by name, Leah by name? Who knows? You have to go teach the next generation because Yaakov's going to have to marry somebody. Maybe even she imagines Esav's going to have to marry somebody. Of course, Esav ends up marrying somebody local, and that's part of the real problem with Esav. And then Yaakov ends up going there, and he meets Rachel, and he meets Leah, and these people do have a concept of monotheism. They do have a concept of one God. They do have a concept of kindness. The kindness that Rachel does for Leah is absolutely, you know, unimaginable. In another context, I've said, why in the world would Yaakov stay after he sees what Lavan pulls on him, Leah, Rachel, this, that, why stay? These people are crazy. Because he sees love and kindness in that house, a sister loving a sister so much, the kind of love that he never imagined and never saw in his house. And therefore he says, you know, this is the kind of love we're going to need in order to build a people. We're going to have people that care about one another. Which means the self-sacrifice of Rachel is something which is as twisted as we may think it. Yaakov may have been attracted, but who taught them? Who in the world taught these people decency? Are you going to tell me Lavan taught them decency? You're going to tell me that that's where it comes from? So the answer, of course, is no. The answer is Devorah. Dvor is the one who teaches Rivka, and Dvor is the one who teaches Rachel and Leah, and Dvor is the one who ultimately is the head of the educational movement, and she's the one who teaches the children of Yaakov as well. And now when it's time to Yaakov to come back home, he takes with him this elderly woman and says, you know, you can retire now. You can come back. You can come home. But she dies along the way, and everybody cries. But why does everybody cry? Because everybody knows who she really is.